Good evening, friends. As was announced, the title being Sensing the Sweet Side of Life. This is a sentence or phrase which comes in one of the letters written by Mr. Crosby, addressing students of the ULT, which was early formed. They were inquiring into the nature of impersonality, which was one of the main policy of the launch, and the policy of what is called the unity among students. These are the two great policies Mr. Crosby emphasized. And therefore, he describes what is it to be impersonal. Now, impersonal ordinarily means denying one's personality. In a way, that is true. But the idea will be, it is not putting your personality in front. That would be an ideal way of putting it. And therefore, he makes that concept of impersonality so beautiful, so remarkable in his letter, that it is worth reading to you. And it is there in the very first quotation. It is extremely touching. And he says for practical purposes, that is for application side, not merely theoretical. Because he ends that letter by saying, it is to become less doctrinal and more human. So the quality of human, qualities that has to come to the forefront, means impersonality. So he says, if you are developing childhood, if you are learning to live things, love things beautiful, if you are becoming more honest, and plain and simple. If you are beginning to sense the sweet side of life, mind you, beginning. So many of these are developing, learning, becoming, beginning. If you are getting to like our friends better and extending the circle, if you feel ourselves expanding in sympathy, if you love to work for theosophy, and do not ask for position as a reward. If you are not bothering too much about whether you are personal or impersonal, this is traveling on the path of impersonality. So much for the individual. For the Theosophical Society of America, impersonality means not to worship itself as an organization. To endeavor to get broader and freer, to merge itself more and more into the living spirit of the movement, its higher self. To neither despise itself because it is form, nor exalt itself because it has a soul. It is to become less doctrinal and more human. So with this long thing, but extremely good, because it tells you the remarkable way in which Mr. Crosby gives a proviso that to be able to sense the sweet side of life, you require two things. One is, of course, the very sense, the perceptive faculty, to be able to perceive things like the poets, like the philosopher. As they say in Gujarati, jana ponche kavi, jana ponche ravi, tya ponche kavi. It's where even the sunlight cannot reach, a poet's heart can reach into the very darkness of the dungeon, as well as the things behind the sun. You know, that kind of perceptive faculty is something that poets intuitively or instinctively possess. So in other words, they have, as the poet says, Keats says, of course, the beauty lies in the eyes of the beholder. That means one must be already a beholder, one must be sensitive spontaneously, naturally, to be able to sense something good in others, to sense beautiful events happening around us. This student once observed while going in a very crowded bus, an old lady sitting in the front part of the bus and an old man sitting little far behind. This lady would turn around again and again, look at him and smile, and he would say, just say hello. And about 5 to 8 times they must have exchanged this kind of feelings. Elderly couple, both with grey hair. It was very touching to the young man. At that time I was a very young person, And it was very touching, seeing old people at this age wanting to see each other, and she would turn around and just look around and he would say, hello. Now, if you are able to see this and enjoy this, it means there must be a perceiver in us. There must be a beholder. That's why I say the beauty lies in the eyes of the beholder. There's another funny story that a fisherman was passing through a garden full of roses. So he felt tired and he lay down. But he couldn't bear the smell of the roses. The fragrance of the roses was too much for him. So he took out the basket and put over his nose. To him, he was enjoying the smell of the fishes rather than the smell of the roses. So he cultivated himself into this way of living. This is cultivation, but it is that inherent in us. As I just mentioned about poets and philosopher like Kant. So this receptivity either is very natural or you have got to develop it. So sensing the sweet side of life as to how we should cultivate this, it is the burden of Buddhist thought. And we can say about good that since you mentioned poets, there are a lot of poetic expressions. For instance, you see children, you know how they enjoy rainbows spontaneously. And that's it, my heart leaps when I behold a rainbow. Roosevelt says that. But then Lee Utang, the philosopher, says, understanding the rainbow is physics. That is, you can physically explain how the rainbow is formed. In our school days, we saw, we know. But to take delight in the rainbow is a lovely heart. So you require a kind of a loveliness in you to be able to enjoy other things of life. Now, as the previous speaker rightly spoke, mentioned, that we are living in a world full of sorrow. Daily we are bombarded with terrible news. Open up newspaper and the very headline is very, it sinks our heart. So continually we are being bombarded by this. With the result that the sensitivity of our heart consciousness becomes blunt and numb. Thank you. So actually it's actually blunted out. It's like an edge. It's blunted out. Continue being exposed to this kind of thing. So for a while, it is good that you must take a little bit of a vacation and go away from all this and never to read a newspaper for 5-6 days of your vacation. And keep your mind closed and be close to nature. This is one of the exercises, very common. But as Mr. Prasadji at one time says that you don't require to go in for a retreat in order to become a spiritual man. You know, need not. You may be in the midst of madness and yet can preserve your sanity. Therefore, you must have the warmth inside of you. As I said, that if a sailor does not have the warmth of his own body, he will freeze outside. So you must preserve the inner warmth in spite of all that madness going on around us. So appreciative quality and the receptivity are inherent and it can be cultivated. But then people say, how can one be joy if one is joyless and grieving and feel empty within? You feel empty within because we are empty within. You see, this is one thing psychologists tell us. If a person feels that he has no meaning in life and feel very empty, it means there is something empty in his heart. That means he doesn't want to allow others to enter his heart. He doesn't want to communicate with others, going out of his way. He expects others to come to him. He expects others to communicate to him. But he doesn't have large heart enough to contain as many number of people within his own heart. Consciousness is not aware of people around him. He is so self-centered. So these people who feel really empty are actually self-centered, psychological. This is what Dr. Eric Fromm says at one place. So these people who find no meaning in life and grieving, and grieving exaggerates, grieving too much. It's great, one can grieve, of course. It is very legitimate. Laughter and tears are most natural to human beings. Human being is the only animal who can laugh at himself and weep. But then, this is natural. But to extend that grief too much and too, then you become so self-centered and therefore you become blunted out. This is a kind of a self-pity. So not to go for that extreme here, what is required is self-forgetfulness. And this self-forgetfulness is given out in this reading that we have. Mr. Crosby is given out beautifully. I mean,
I think we can only take that and enlarge the whole lecture on that. He says, developing a child. That is the child's heart which can spontaneous. This is spontaneous, it is not about self-conscious. They can tell you blunt truth on our face. They are being fear. Let them natural. That's what he says, no? Becoming honest, plain and simple. This is the characteristic of a baby, a child. He can spontaneously. This is exactly what happened. You say, I saw a movie called Frankenstein. And there is a great monster. He became, you know, he was created by a scientist, a great giant monster, who began started destroying things. So he came across a baby girl, and he picked that up, and about to lash her. But the girl spontaneously smiled at him, because she saw something funny about him. So she smiled at him, so he stopped. Then she offered a rose, a flower in her hand. And he was stunned. He put that baby down. He gently put down. All the ferocity of his nature was for a moment lost. In fact, scientists used this baby in order to trap him. Later on in that story, this is what she saw the movie about 30 years ago. But it's like that. So spontaneous behavior on the point of child is very touching. So we have to develop this kind of spontaneity, capable of spontaneously responding to others with a smile, with a hello. As I said, with a bye that I just saw about that old couple. And to be able to notice it. See, we are so absorbed in our own petty life that we have no time for seeing these wonderful things that are happening around us. You see the movement of the little crawling animals, and you can see the wonder in which they are moving. People have studied insects, you see, they have written thesis on it because they have studied this behavior. But it's extremely interesting if you know how to. There's a very good book called Miracle of Life, in which wonderful stories of this kind are given about how the animal world behave. That apart. Secondly, getting to like our friends better. See, we don't like our friends. Getting to like our friends better. To be able to do that, we must be able to see the good side of our friend, the positive side of him, and try to forget something that is already about him. And more important, extending the soul. This is practical as well as mystical. You see, by extending circle, doesn't mean you have a large number of friends, inviting them in your house, making a club out of it. It doesn't mean that. It doesn't mean going out of your way to create friends. It may be to a certain extent too, and very useful to some extent. You see, I remember the story of old students of theosophy, while going back from Churchgate home. They would make friends with neighboring crowd in their train on Sunday night. And distribute, you see, our pamphlets to them, and then introduce theosophy to them by befriending them. Senior students doing it, I was told from their own mouth. Now this kind of befriending is expanding the circle. That there is an inward expansion of the circle. You see that you become concerned about others. That expanding wider and wider sympathy, wider and wider concern for other people's values, other people's feelings. You should be sensitive to other people's feelings. If people don't like this thing, supposing people don't like smoke, then for God's sake, don't smoke for the sake of others. Or people don't like making some kind of, supposing I'm making my food like this constantly, and people don't like this. For the sake of the audience, let me not do it. You need to be sensitive to the others. That is what is meant by expanding the circle. And not bothering about whether you are personal or impersonal. This is technical. And says, oh, less doctrinal and more human. So this human quality, I mean by human it means, because we are a mixture of the animal in us, we are a mixture of something purely human, and we are also something of the divine, something beautiful, godlike. So we are a mixture of all that. Let the human side of it come to forefront and express itself. So these are the preconditions, or necessary conditions for becoming more human, and less self-forgetfulness, because it's only when we are concerned about others you forget yourself less. And it is better that we forget ourselves more, less, than we can concern about ourselves with others. Then the other qualities that you require to build, certainly. One is, of course, capacity for appreciation. You know, there is such a there are classes going on for music appreciation and aesthetic appreciation, art appreciation. That also is a part of the thing, but that's not important. We are not talking of beautiful things only. I mean, simple things can become beautiful. I'm told that in the Japanese art, if you go to a home of some artistic Japanese, they've got very clumsy looking stones lying on their shelves. Those clumsy looking stones, to that Japanese, he sees some beauty in that beautiful stone. That stone to him appears beautiful because he is able to see a form in it, a certain representative of something in it. Which to us is a stone, rough looking, you. Leave aside going to a natural environment and going to a natural park and enjoying it. That also necessary. See, appreciation is a quality which increases awareness. Become aware of what's happening around. But at least excellence in others, worth in others, at least we can appreciate that. A good story that comes to a year now, recently, you know, during this bomb blast. Wonderful stories came in front about how people went out of the way to help others. I mean, our heart should rejoice. If I was not there, but wonderful thing has happened. Thank God this has happened. And we say, hey, Salam Bombay and all those things, we are of course boastfully talking. But it's true that if we can observe these beautiful things that are happening around us, you become less personal. You are away from your own petty little concerns and talking about. You see, there are ugly side of things. A bomb blast is a tremendously ugly thing. But there is a rosy side. So every dark event is also the rosy silver line. To be able to observe the silver lining is something we have to appreciate, we have to cultivate. And another thing, we have to dwell on that. And that is where the Saint Paul comes to our rescue. It's beautiful. I really like it very much. Saint Paul's epistle. He says, on the second page, whatever things are true, whatever things are honest, whatever things are just and pure and lovely, whatever things are good report, whatever, if you find there is any virtue, if there is any praise, if it is something praiseworthy, he says, think on this thing, think on it. I mean, it means dwell on it. It means first of all, be receptive to it, be sensitive to it. And aspire towards it. And share it with others. If you come up with something great story, share it. Share it, let it go and go around. See, nowadays this book, which is called Chicken Soup for This Cat, Chicken Soup for the Mother, Chicken Soup for the Ladies, it's really beautiful, this thing. This is a way of sharing lives of wonderful, ordinary human beings like you and me, and their happy life. Their great contribution to making this world a happy place to live in. That's what you want. You make the world, you make it so that at the end of your life, when we depart, people should feel the void. People should feel that they miss you. Because you have contributed to their happiness. You have contributed to something in their life. So, looking at this, to be able to see the truth, goodness and beauty, that's the artistic. St. Paul mentioned it because he once at one place says that the three cardinal virtues are truth, goodness and beauty. They are the great virtues according to Christian philosophy. So he talks about this truthfulness, honesty, justness, purity, loveliness and things which come good report and proclaim them. And because they are the stuff of which real man is made. The real inner man is made up of this kind of stuff. It's not made up of this animal kind thing which our psychologists are constantly telling us that apart. See, most of the time we are busy with our petty personal life. It's absolutely, you might say, as Dr. Fromm said, it's a non-productive living, non-productive orientation. Non-productive because what are you producing? At least the mothers are producing something. Looking after the baby, bringing them. That's why somewhere in America, somewhere in Europe, I think, we read it somewhere in Reader's Digest. A statistics was done as to how many happy people are there. Just a man who stood and asked, are you happy, are you happy, are you happy? He asked this question, how many degrees? And you find among them, women were more happy than men. And among the women, married women with children were extremely happy.
this kind of fulfillment in a womanhood is the fulfillment of motherhood. I mean, this is their characteristic. This gives them happiness. To be able to rejoice with women's happiness is a great thing. You see, a husband should be able to rejoice his wife's happiness being pregnant. That's a part. So you mean, to be able to see this side of life and appreciate it is something which we can cultivate and dwelling on it. So we can be away from this petty personal life if we live this kind of productive life. And then we have a very negative self-image. It is because constantly the church has bombarded into a blame that we are born sinners, that we are helpless human beings. We constantly depend upon God, we constantly depend upon church, we also depend upon fire, temple, this, that. External things by which only there are the crutches which alone can take us to hell. We have lost the touch of true human nature, which is intrinsically divine. Again and again, it is the burden of theosophical doctrine. It is the central teaching of theosophy. That man is a child of light. That at the core of his being is luminous. Only thing is, it is covered over by this external chimney, which is full of soots, full of dirt and dust, which just requires to be cleansing. Otherwise, there is the light within. This is the affirmation theosophy brings. So this, and secondly, you see our morbid internals. You look at the television serials, very morbid, extremely the negative side of human nature. Here and there they see, these children saw this bold and beautiful. Sometimes you worship that heroic person, and after all, sometimes this fellow behaves in such a dirty way, you couldn't believe that that great person could behave this way. So suddenly the turn of the story shows the ugly side of that man's nature. On one side, and mind you, one place is a great, well-known psychologist who had written wonderful books and a great teacher. But then later on, he was a kind of a pathologist himself, a psychopath himself. You are continually being bombarded this kind of television serials where there are spooks and horrors. Don't expose yourself to that. This TV says, I see somewhere, that those who are interested in such horror things, they develop what is called evil eye. For a long time, if you keep on seeing such things and enjoying it, mind you. Our children, you see, nowadays they write these horror stories, horror books. We find them in our libraries. Take it away from them. Don't let them read them too much. Occasionally, yes. But what happens, you see, these horror things, I have been telling my grandchildren this. Someday you will develop an ugly eye. So whatever eyes you put into it, it will get spoiled. This is what is called the evil eye. So don't do that. Read something beautiful, great. Great stories of great people. And then you will not only try to imitate them or emulate them, but something, some great change will happen to you. So company of the great, that's what our reading says. No? The company of the wise gives you happiness. Because it elevates you, our consciousness is raised. Mere silent company, you know how to talk with a great person. Just walk with that person along. And in his presence, that person's aura, that person radiates something of it. Even if he puts his hand on your shoulder, it's enough. You have been transformed to that extent if you are receptive. So this kind of receptivity is something we have to develop in us. And this companions of newspapers, TV series, books, morbid interests, and even academicians and you see newspaper thinkers, you see what is the kind of thinking? Totally cynical. You see, cynical means non-trusting. You don't trust, it seems that politicians don't seem to trust each other. Even politicians belong to the same Congress or this or that party, they don't trust each other. They have become cynical, they have lost faith in each other. It is because continually they are being bombarded with this negative image about human beings, that human being has gone to gold, I say. So gone to dust, gone to bad words are used. So hard, unfeeling roughness comes over us if you allow yourself to be exposed. So don't come in touch with such people, avoid. Don't read newspaper in the early morning, please. Read something beautiful, read something novel, listen to music. You see, our ears are no longer sensitive to ear. You see, our ear has to be sensitized to music.
Of course, some children are born inclined to music. You see, they have musical ears. But then you have to cultivate. There is something that can be cultivated for art, for beauty, for companionship, for lovely things of life, for fragrance, and for food even. Nothing wrong. If you like something good in food, enjoy it. Now about another thing, about optimism. That is another way by which you can able to see the bright side of life. Because bright outlook means optimistic. As one of the quotations here, Your Majesty says, that see, the optimist, he says, sees the donut, but the pessimist sees the hole. You know, if there is a donut, that's all for him, it's donut, just right, you know, it's hungry, it's donut. But the writer says, oh, there is a hole in it. Like that. If there is a cup full, there is a half full, the fellow says the cup is half full, half empty. The other says the cup is half full. So this kind of optimism is something that you have to cultivate. That also ultimately builds up. And like the poet, he says, all is right with the world. You dare to claim that all is right with the world, and courageously see, have the right outlook. If you have the right outlook, you carry it with you and you transmit it to others. And this is our responsibility, which is about which we are going to speak, dwell on it. But then, how to be optimistic when you see everything going wrong, everything going to the dogs, as the speaker said. It is. Face it. But don't dwell on it. Face it squarely. Go to the root cause. Root cause is lower human nature. As it to be says, because our eyes are riveted to the earth, earthly. We don't look up to the heavenwards. We have lost the art of looking up to the heaven. He says figuratively. And she then changes it. Not upwards, inwards. From time to time, if you can look inwards from the heaven, which is the best form of prayer, turning inwards and being in companionship with another. Somebody once asked, how to meditate? She says, very simple. Become like a baby, fall into the lap of your mother and go to sleep. I mean, this kind of trustingly going into the lap of your mother, how the baby feels about it? Trustingly. If you can feel like that in the presence of the divine, that is the right kind of meditation. You know, this is spontaneous. It comes to you naturally. This is the right form of meditation if it comes to you naturally. So optimism means faith. And faith, as I just mentioned, the very origin of man. Man is born in divinity. And it's on his return path. See, he is come land. See, with trailing clouds of glory. I am not going to read that in your quotation. That the man is born with a trailing cloud of glory. That is like a star, and there is a whole glorious cloud behind him. And then he is going to return back to his own home. And that home is the divinity itself. And therefore, both ways, both at the beginning, the origin and the destiny of man is great. If he can keep continuing, and this is a burden of theosophical teaching. The central teaching of theosophy is that man is intrinsically a divine being on his return path. That the whole journey of life is returning. And returning joyfully. You see that in the company of each other. You see that's so hand in hand. Traveling the path is a difficult path, no doubt. Full of thorns, full of stones, full of exertion. But then if we can help each other, naturally then the journey can become. Give a good company to your friends when you are traveling, don't we? Give each other company. Very often you see in a company, we take a person who knows a lot of humor, another person who knows beautiful mouth organ. You see, that's how when you go for a picnic. You rather prefer a person who can keep the atmosphere lively. So, and you become one of them, why not? Why invite others to your company? Let's be like that. Because man is originally a great being. Another thing, complete faith in the law. The faith that whatever happens is for the good. Whatever terrible thing may happen to you, have faith that somewhere behind this, something good will happen. There are many stories that are connecting that, we have no time for that. But there are such things happening that even a wrong thing may happen, but in the long run you will go back and see, thank God this has happened to me. Worse could have happened. It could have been worse. But if it has been only this much, be happy that it is only. If I have lost one eye, I should be happy it is only one eye. Like that. So see the opposite, optimistic side of life and trust to accept
life as it comes, joyfully accepting, not only accepting, bending your back or turning around or looking down, but gladly. Accept it and say that let's go on, forget about what has happened, that tomorrow is my day, let's go ahead forward. And see this excellent concept of life and marvelous human nature, if you can continually dwell on it, for that you require good literature. And Bhagavad Gita is the wonderful book which, and Dhammapada. This is something, this particular chapter of happiness, this student reads again and again, because it gives real happiness. Because the first six para tells you how not to do it. Then only you can be happy. Free from anxiety, free from struggle, free from doubt, free from suspicion, free from tension, free from strife. Be free. And then free from your own possession. And then you can enjoy. You see? So this is a kind of enjoyment one can undergo. I think we have told that story very often. Would you like to recite it? You see, there was a fisherman who had carried about 7-8 fishes early morning. He used to get a very early morning catch fishes, about 5, 10, 20, to his heart's satisfaction, and then lie down and sleep and enjoy and whistle. So one rich man came and said, "Hey young man, what are you doing?" He just smiled at him. "Come and get a whistle." "But why?" "Come on, go and work." "Yeah, I've done my work." He says, "Hey, go and do a fishing, more fishes." "What for?" "Hey, you earn more fishes, go and make a lot of money." "What for?" "Then you can buy a big trawler, have a big business out of this." "But so what?" "Oh, that, and you can enjoy yourself, not relax." He said, "What I'm doing now? I'm doing right away, I'm enjoying myself. I will have enough fishes." So, I mean, that fellow has his own limits of ambition. And each one must be ambitious. "Oh, my bank balance is this much, I should be satisfied. If it just keeps my body and soul together, happy." Why cultivate lot of money? America, you see, look at the condition of the American. This fellow is sad when he sees ambition, ambition, continually driving the country to war, to this, to that. They are highly ambitious people, absolutely restless. And then very acquisitive, very possessive, wants to possess. You see, I've got one car, I must have two. Like that kind of thing. Commercialization, consumerization. Now, this is a kind of cultivation. Is that a great civilization? We want an advanced civilization. Advanced civilization which once India was. Advancement in spiritual nature, advancement in heart quality. If we can cultivate that, then of course we are extremely sensitive to good side of life. And the psychologist Fromm says, he says, mind you, he was a psychoanalyst, and he says, man is here to evolve and finally even to exceed himself, not only to become man and up to the highest man that is capable, to become Superman and finally to exceed himself, that is to become what one is potential. That means there is a psychologist who senses that man, he has not reached his ultimatum, he has not reached his ultimate pinnacle of growth. That the best that we know of a man is merely just the beginning. There is yet great things to plan. So he senses it. So he is one of the very positive humanistic philosopher, thinker and psychoanalyst who says that there is a great thing. So let us be human first. And by human he means the positive side of humanity. And he, there are the psychologists who have done research work in the colleges, and they have found that there have been needs, called behavioral psychologists. And they said that human being is driven by our needs and by our drives. And that there are basic biological needs. Then there are basic psychological needs, like companionship, by belonging to a group, by people admiring you, by recognition and so on. But then there is some higher need in man. That higher need in man is to excel himself. He wants to become better than himself. Not only better in the sense of financially, or better intellectually, or better having number of more degrees. I'm a PhD, I'm going to become a second PhD. It's not in that sense. But truly to the last day of life, you can become better and better and better. And this kind of excelling oneself is the kind of pursuit is to be true to yourself. Because we are true to yourself, our self wants to grow. The very nature of the soul is to unfold. That is his need. Because now it is in a bud form. But inside of it, as I told you, it's light. It wants to burst forth into a great flower, but it grows slow. And we must allow it time. As Mr. Crosby said, give it time. In time it will flower forth. So don't expect tomorrow to become saints. But then the first step has to be taken. So we must have to cultivate this. And therefore, it's not enough, therefore, to be good. As Mr. Just says, it's not enough to be just good today. You must have knowledge. That's why we are here. That's why for years together, Theosophical Movement continually harping on again and again, repeating the same thing ad nauseam, the three fundamental propositions, and the basis of which the whole superstructure of Theosophy is based. And the structure is very simple, it's a triangle. God on the top, evolution on the other, and the law, fundamental law. That the universe is an orderly universe of law. If you can believe that this is an orderly universe of law, then everything is lawful, everything that exists, exists under law. And therefore anything that happens to me, happens under law. So why blame others? Why blame outside things? Blame my own sowing of the seeds for which I am now reaping the fruits thereof. If that convinces, if we are really convinced of that law, and think that whatever happens, happens for the good of me. Positive side of the law, not the punishment side of the law. But that it not only comes as retribution, but gives me better opportunity to become better. You see, the life is an opportunity. It's an opportunity to improve oneself, to overcome our defects, to become better for our next incarnation, to carry with us what kind of luggage to heaven. We carry with us that good thing that we have done here, the good thoughts and good feelings that we have aspired. It is that we can take to Devaka, and that which can bring it back. So cultivating that. So this is our, what is called the treasure in heaven, as the Bible says. Our treasures in heaven are those good quality of thinking, feeling. So that St. Paul says that let us dwell on those things long enough and wait, then we can. And knowledge. Because this knowledge, without knowledge, mere faith, kind of a hope and faith that we develop, can become purely religious, can become superstitious. Our faith must have some way. This is, of course, intuitive. You see, when the poet says, all is well with the world, he says that spontaneously. Most poets have always said the rosy side of life. You see, even the poet, I forgot about that person, he died very young, but most of his poems, there were very pathos on one side. But at the center of the pathos, there was some pure side of beauty. He was able to sense the beautiful side of human life. And though he was also pointing to the pathos, the sad part of it, which touched him very deeply, because he was mystical. He saw that life, he was not happy with his own life, because he felt it was incomplete, physically also. And therefore he wanted to shine out. And the body couldn't bear the burden of that inner burning ambition to become greater and better. So he died of tuberculosis at a very young age. So I think Shelley, it's a life of Shelley. So these great poems, they have that intuitive way of looking at the bright side of life. They are able to confront even the ugly side of life courageously, but never losing the staff in their hand, the staff that Theosophy provides, the staff that human being in his true nature is great, and he can become greater. And there are greater heights to be carried onwards, and positively if we can carry on and help each other, of course, each other to carry on, that is. But then for that we require self-forgetfulness, forgetting our own woes, concern ourselves with others, and that's the way to do it. So the basis of faith, of course, is just also the three laws, and then it just says, finally, if we can practice benevolence, tenderness, complacency. Complacency means, I don't care. Complacency means, all right, accept it. It brings about cheerfulness of the mind, which tends to strengthen and to stand. Not only that, but we owe it to others. And this is what I would like to read, the last thing.
how our thoughts can influence it. You see, because if you are depressed, you depress others. If you are clumsy, you make others clumsy. If you carry yourself with long faces, you make others long. If you carry the wrong aura around you, naturally you are contaminating other people's atmosphere. So it should be very strongly says, every person who draws the breath of life, and she uses the word breath of life, mind you, that is some mystical meaning, man. You see, by breathing out, you are throwing out certain elementals which can touch others. So out breathing and in breathing, you take in either the positive elementals into you or the negative. So this pranayama has got deeper meaning. It not only means mere physical breathing, it means taking in the pure prana inside of you and bringing out the pure prana which comes out of you. And so every person who draws the breath of life affects, it's not that in your reading, the mental and the moral atmosphere of the world. Mental and moral atmosphere of the world. And help to color the day of those about them. I mean around you. Right? Color the day itself. You can spoil the day of your friends, of your neighbor, of your wife, of your children, because you got up clumsily, complainingly, with long face. And she says, those who do not help to elevate the thoughts and life of others must of necessity either paralyze them by indifference or actively drag them down. So this is our contribution. What you want to do? And then she says, in secret doctrine, very important, when a thought of a good or evil import is begotten, given birth, you give birth in your mind. When a thought of good or evil import is begotten in your brain, it draws to it impulses of, in bracket, elements, events, persons, it attracts to it of like nature. As irresistibly as the magnet attracts iron filings. So, and then later on she said, if you can forcibly impress a great thought, that thought has impressed itself into the great cosmic atmosphere, what is called the Akasha. And it remains there for ages sometimes, Iskubi says. And then when the time comes, it descends, that thought forms, and elevates the mind of the race. So the great thoughts thought out in the past life by great beings, this can influence even now, today. Of course, they have left behind the footprints on the sand of time. In the great book like Bhagavad Gita, the great scriptures of the world, the great writings, you see, it's there for us. But then they have left behind the great thoughts. So thoughts are more strongly impressed upon the book of nature, the what is called the table of nature, on which it is impressed permanently, and when the right time comes, it descends on us and can fill our heart with that. So he says, so Ishwari says, we have got the power to attract these positive thoughts in us, or we attract bad elemental, we have just told you about this, evil eye, or auspicious person. That's why in our old tradition, it is said that if, during the Diwali time, that the house must be clean, and it must be organized, and things must be placed in the right shape, disorderliness must be removed. The idea being that you attract Lakshmi, Shri, who is presiding over auspiciousness. So Lakshmi doesn't mean money or wealth, it means auspiciousness. Good things can happen in that home, which is organized, orderly, harmonious in its own, not only at the last time of the Diwali period, the 5 days of Diwali, but throughout the year if we can make harmonious living within ourselves, and you'll find that that home prospers. That home prospers and the neighborhood also prospers. It has its influence, invisible influence. It may not make a mark on us, but it will make a definite mark if you believe in that law of what is called the law of affinity. That is a tremendous law. It's an occult law which impresses. Even the things that we touch with an evil thought or with a strong angry thought, wherever that thing goes, it passes on that impression. It's dangerous to think dangerous things because you are harming others. You are contaminating others. These are the germs you are spreading. The other way around, if we can consciously see that, seeing in our own home, we can help others. Without lifting a finger, without going out, without even lecturing, without doing anything, just sit down and think, what is among the Buddhism, what is called this Maitri Bhavana. It's a wonderful meditation that I think good of everybody around me. First of all, I bless myself. I bless my immediate family. I bless my immediate surrounding. I bless my country. I bless my surrounding. I bless the whole universe. Everyone, that expanding concern of love and Maitri, friendship. If you can expand that circle, this little meditation which you can do, there will be a return coming back to us. Very soon, we can overcome the clouds that have been surrounding us, which we have a reason to grieve about. And that clouds can be dispelled by this kind of Maitri. We have 5 minutes to answer your questions. How to see? You must have eye to see. Nobody, you see, somebody asked a poet, poet, how can I become a poet? How can I become a poet? This student asked a person who was very much fond of poetry. He says, yes, we have got a lot of poetic appreciation. How can I cultivate that? He says, read poem. Read poems. I asked him, how to cultivate appreciation? He says, but read. Try. So to be able to see in a cabbage something beautiful, you require eye. But if you are really able to see good things of life around you, sooner or later you are able to see even in a crude things. I am telling you honestly, my children picks up a stone from the road and comes and shows me. He says, I picked it up. God knows what that child saw in that stone. But you laugh with that child, you enjoy, you show that you are happy about it. I couldn't see anything in that stone, honestly. But I could see that the child is happy about this. Well, I enjoyed it. I have not enjoyed the stone, I enjoyed her smile, I enjoyed the child's little innocent heart. We enjoyed the stone, collecting stones, honestly. I am telling you the truth. My grandchild is collecting stones. Well, 5-year-old girl. So this is what happens. You see others enjoying it and enjoy it, of course. If others are laughing, laugh with them. Even if you are not able to enjoy the joke. Well, be at least be in the company of people who are jovial. I once asked a friend, who was a marvelous storyteller and a marvelous joke teller. If he opens his mouth, he will tell 100 jokes. You can't even stop him. He said, I asked him, my friend, you are a professional colleague, how could you remember so many jokes? He said, when I read jokes, I mentally feel that I am going to tell this joke to so-and-so. This joke is meant for my wife. This joke is meant for this friend. This joke is meant for this professional people. This joke is good for women. This joke is joke for politicians. This joke is... So he was compartmentalized them. And that is his way of remembering joke. So in the company of the doctors, he was a doctor. He would rattle out wonderful jokes, pulling their legs. And in the company of dailies, he would make them laugh. You see, because he had made a little mental effort, he says, he wanted to make happiness happen. So, because of this, he is able to see the beauty of those jokes. Sometimes very funny, sometimes very stupid jokes, sometimes very hot jokes, sometimes very dirty jokes, I agree. But all the same, he was making others happy. His motive was because he was a very unhappy man himself, I know it. Not a very happy man, yes, very miserable child. But he wanted to make others happy. And therefore he made efforts to remember jokes. So making an effort is a way of learning. You know, to be able to see beauty in anything uncouth, it requires something. At least at present we are at least happy to see other people's good character. As intellectuals and people who continually think, at least we admire other people's good nature, good happiness, good things of life. We are not yet very sensitive to the atmosphere of the nature, as poets are. But slowly, slowly it can be cultivated. And at least reading poems can make you at least learn, become a little bit of a poetic heart. Then you start writing your own poems and try the clumsy way of doing it, no matter. Nobody reads it, but at least make an attempt. So try. Try is the first message. And keep in touch with beautiful teaching of Theosophy. This is something which lifts us up, lifts us up. And if you, and I think mine should be a last word, which I just said this morning. A very senior student in his very last meeting in our Matunga Lodge, because afterwards he left Bombay and went away. Very old man. And he says, at the closing of the meeting, he says, if Theosophy has not made you sweet, that means Theosophy has not yet touched you. You are not yet really touched by Theosophy if it has not made you sweet. So the sweetness quality should come front, come in front. All the roughness part of it should gradually be shaped out of you. Then at the end of it, that's a test. Whether Theosophy, not the number of pages of secret doctrine you can remember. See, that's what Mr. Cosby says, no? Not to be doctrinal, but to be human. It's necessary that you have to make very hard work to learn from secret doctrine. But at the end of it, somebody wrote to HBB and says, is that how you should study Theosophy, study secret doctrine? And he says, you must see a central thread in that. And the central thread is the man, the divine man. He was able to sense that intuitively. And HBB said, great. That was, HBB smiled. He didn't say yes. She smiled on him and says, yes, yes, this is the way, that is the central teaching. The whole thread of secret doctrine is the greatness of man. That's one thread. He was able to see. So to be able to see through this beauty within this uncouth and clumsy things can be cultivated. Thank you.